6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places.
And welcome to this Monday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host, John Quinlan. Coming up in the next hour, a very special show we've been looking forward to all month, a chance to pay tribute to both Gene and Linda Farley, two people who were part of a couple that it's really hard to separate out their legacy of activism, their work on behalf of peace, health reform, trying to counter the effects of global climate change. They work in so many different areas, and it's epitomized by the great work that continues to be done at the Farley Center. And that's one of the things we'll be talking about in the next hour, ways that their legacy will live on. Throughout the hour, I'm going to be hearing from quite a number of folks, and I'm just going to go through without identifications, and we'll get to those as each person has a chance to speak. But joining us on the phone from out of Colorado is Shed Farley, representing his generation, one of four, or as you define it, five sons, I guess, actually, of the Farleys. Hey, Shed, welcome to A Public Affair.
Morning, John. It's nice to be here.
Glad you could be here. Then also in studio, we're joined by Dr. John Fry. John was the person who I know you were saying it's problematic. No one could succeed Gene Farley, but took over his duties at the UW School of Medicine Family Practice Division, and he'll have his thoughts in just a moment. Also, Chad Farley, who is Gene and Linda's grandson, talking about perspectives of his generation. Janet Parker is here from the Farley Center. State Senator Mark Miller is here, and we're going to be talking about aspects of the Farley's work on behalf of health care reform. Joe and Joanne Elder are here, lifelong friends of the Farleys, members of Quaker Meeting, colleagues on issues of peace and justice and many other different issues. And Almy Baldwin is also with us today, and she's the president of the Farley Center, of course, someone who also has a large range of activism on behalf of Native American issues, the environment, other issues resonant with that mission of the Farley Center. And despite a somewhat crowded panel today, we also welcome your calls, your thoughts on the Farleys. As we get started here, I had a very special message on the voicemail at home this morning from U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, who wanted to weigh in and offer her memories of Gene and Linda Farley.
Hi, this is Tammy Baldwin calling. I wanted to reflect in this season of Thanksgiving on my gratitude for the life and legacy of the doctors Gene and Linda Farley. You know, they were an incredible couple and incredible individuals. And I am so grateful for the fact that I got to meet both of them about 20 years ago in organizing around the issue of universal health care and a single-payer system. I got to know Gene and Linda very well as advocates, but as I attended each of their memorial services after each of them passed away, Gene most recently, I also got to hear from so many in the medical community about their role as mentors and doctors. They have left an incredible legacy of activism, advocacy, and care. They are role models for so many in the political arena and the medical field. But they were also just warm and loving people who care about others, care about the earth, our planet, and the future. And they are very, very missed. But they have left so many others who were touched by their example to continue to lead.
And again, that was U.S. Representative, excuse me, now U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, remembering 20 years of relationship working with Linda and Gene as colleague and as friend. We wanted to start it out today, I guess, before we get into some of the areas of activism and some of the accomplishments that that both Farleys achieved in this world, just to talk about issues of family and what it was like growing up with Linda and Gene, both as father and as grandfather and grandmother and mother. And Shed, I defer to you, but what was unusual, or what were some of the special aspects of having Gene and Linda as your parents?
Well, there are lots of things that kind of made it unique, but for me anyway, I didn't really realize what a unique upbringing we had until I was, you know, much into my adult years. For one thing, I think right from the start, just the era that we all grew up in. I was born in 1959, so I was very young during the civil rights era. But that whole atmosphere pretty much permeated our house and affected a lot, I believe, on how we were raised. I mean, my mom and dad, both of them, just had all the faith in the world about people. And so that kind of let them give the four boys, and later the fifth, a freer rein than many parents had. So I don't know, I could go into details about the kinds of things we did that we thought were normal and that no other parents would even consider letting their kids do. And from an early age, each one of us had started hitchhiking cross-country, pretty much no questions. And while I guess they were probably worried sometimes, but they let us do what we did and had faith in us and had faith in other people. And I think that was a huge part of our upbringing.
You know, both parents clearly were folks that did landmark work in terms of racial economic justice, in terms of breakthroughs and encouraging folks to be their full selves. Your mom became a doctor at a time when women weren't encouraged in that area. Your dad, from an early age, had, I think, a deep understanding of what racism was all about. Are those values that just kind of wove themselves into to your lives as well?
You know, I think looking back on it, there are several things that we never questioned. And probably many of those things focus on civil rights. Even as a young kid, I could never understand, okay, what is wrong with being homosexual? I could never understand, okay, why are this group of people being treated different than anybody else? And it's just grown. It was, yes, I would say it was kind of woven into the whole everything about growing up Farley. So, if that answers your question, at least a little bit, then...
No, that's a great start, Shed. Thank you for giving us sort of a quick picture. Shed, I think we're going to work around the table, but again, we'll weave you into the conversation at a number of different points here. And, please, again, do interject yourself in if there's something you'd like to comment on. But I promise to be back to you in just a moment. But next thing is I wanted to go to your nephew, Chad Farley, who's here. He's...
Hey, Chad.
Hi. And he's at the UW Law School. My sense of just going through your grandparents' Facebook page and talking to them, I had great pleasure of having lunch with Gene just a couple months ago after he was on the show here, most grandparents, I think, you know, certainly have a real vested interest in their grandkids. But boy, there just seemed to be such a bond there, such a joy of sharing adventure. And it just strikes me, you know, especially strong given the two of them were so young at heart. Does that all that make sense for you? And what are some of your special memories?
I guess a lot of my memories of my grandparents were just the fact that they were extremely involved. I grew up in Texas, so I was a little far away. But they always wanted to make sure that we had... special memories with them. So, when I was 22, 23, somewhere around there. They wanted to make sure that me, my brother, and sister all made it to like a progressive conference to really get involved and see what was going on. And that's actually where I got back together with my wife. And then when I moved into Madison a couple months ago, my grandfather, he was really adamant that I become part of the Farley Center for Peace, Justice, and Sustainability. One day he asked me for my resume, and it's like, what do you need my resume for, Grandpa? I'm not sure what you need it for. And he's like, well, I'm proposing that you should be a board member. It's like, oh, well, and he just didn't give me a choice about it. He wanted to make sure that I was involved, and he got it. I'm a board member now, so, and hopefully get to make some difference on the board. So that'd be great.
But my sense is that your grandparents also really embraced the natural world. You know, that was part of their activism. Mm-hmm. That's part of the philosophy of the Farley Center. You have memories of trips you took together, places you went that gave you that sense of appreciation?
Certainly. I actually had a really great trip with my grandmother and grandfather and my cousin Ben. They took us on like a safari to Africa, and we got to see just the world, and which was just amazing, just seeing all the life and everything. They'd been wanting to do that forever, but and even more than that, just their property out in Verona has always been amazing, and just being it's just a beautiful spot.
Shed, do you have any special memories of trips you all took together or special?
Oh man,
yeah,
holy cow. Unfortunately, my daughter was born a little late to get the same treatments that Chad and Becca and Shay and Justin, I think, even. I'm not even sure, though, of most of the older ones than Grace. But we had, I don't know, some of you are familiar with their I think it's a Toyota with a camper shell on top. Little Toyota truck with a camper shell. And one summer, they came out to Colorado with and Josh and Andrea and Liam and I think Yasmin was even born, and Grace and myself, so seven of us, piled into this little camper and went on a 10-day trip in southern Utah. And you'd think that seven people, those of you who know the size of that camper, we'd drive each other nuts, but holy cow, it's Grace's fondest memories. And Grace, by the way, is my daughter, so her, my parents somewhat sixth or so grandkids, so or seventh or I don't know how many. But anyway, there's so many things. My grandparents are very close to every one of their grandchildren. I just find it amazing how they did that. There's other memories of our land in New York that myself and Grace and Caroline would go to, and those memories are the most cherished memories I have, and they are for my daughter as well. Two places that she'd rather go than anywhere else are Wisconsin, like Chad said, and New York.
Shed, when we were talking last night, you were telling me, I think, that surprised you on some level, you know, I'm sure had a sense of the many contributions that your mom and dad made here in Madison and in this part of the world, but it still was in some ways kind of amazing to see the variety of people, the other folks who turned it out from the memorial. Am I right? In some ways, has this been a time when you've had a renewed appreciation for the ways they've made contributions here?
Not a renewed appreciation, an appreciation, because even growing up, you know, they never shorted us on any kind of the parenting skills, and even when we were very young, they were active in every community they were in, but it never affected how much they gave to us as well. I think, you know, if there are any limitless resources, some people's love is just amazing. I don't know how they did it. I can only hope that in my future life I'll be able to meet that to some extent. They were always involved with us, along with always being involved with everybody else.
All right. Well, thank you again, Shed.
Growing up, you're talking about the different people. Even growing up, we always had almost somebody staying with us. We had an English family of five staying with us for, several months. We had an inner city kid who stayed with us for, a year or so, just to get him out of the ghettos and see what the rest of life looks like. Doesn't say we had a lasting impact, but maybe we did. It sure opened our eyes.
Yeah.
When we have people.
I remember one thing we talked about last night before we move around the table here that we wanted to emphasize. So the four of you as his sons, I think each have embraced vocational work or dedication to causes that are resonant with your parents. And maybe if we could just go on and name each of your siblings and kind of where you're at and the kind of work you do. But in the course of that conversation, of course, you kind of corrected me. And then, in fact, in some ways, the Farleys consider that they had five sons. And maybe you could also explain Patrick's story.
Oh, sure. Patrick is the son of Josephat and Alexis Malungu, who were Ugandan natives and had come over here for education and met my parents. Patrick was born here, which gave him dual citizenship, which plays into the story. Then they moved back to Uganda. And that was a period of time when Idi Amin was in power. And I think Patrick was 10, I'm not sure, 10 or 11. And they asked my parents if they could send Patrick to be educated in America, and he was the only one of their three kids, that had American dual citizenship. And after much discussion, because that was a big responsibility to take on somebody else's child for the next indefinite number of years, at least through high school and into college. And, of course, they decided, yes, we'll do this. And so Patrick was, from pretty early on in his life and pretty early on in my life, was just part of the family. And, and he still is. So that's what I can say. And his family is part of the family, so it's really nice. So that's the story of Patrick. He now lives in Kenya.
Ian, Shed, just briefly, if you could just describe what your vocational work is, where you are, and each of the same for each of your three brothers.
Let's see. My oldest brother has a big company. My older brother is a doctor who runs a bunch of stuff, and My younger brother is a professor, and Patrick is a professional over in Uganda. I'm the blue collar guy. So I'm a builder, a general contractor, and how that fits in with my parents' visions are probably that they think that I can save the world by building incredibly efficient houses, which I try to do. I'm not saving the world.
Well, that's great. And again, please feel free to chime in as we go around the table here. Joseph Elder is, many of you folks know, of course, through his work in the Department of South Asian Studies, but he's also a lifelong Quaker who works on issues of international justice and that and many other capacities. Joe, if you could pull the mic a little closer here, and I know that you had the honor of helping to assemble folks for the memorial service that occurred shortly after Gene's passing. Could you describe the scene that night, some of the sense of community that was there? And in a minute, we can maybe talk about his work and Linda's as his Quakers.
It was an amazing memorial service. Gene and Linda were both Quakers. The first time we met them was when they showed up in a Quaker meeting. We have a fairly small group, so when a vigorous couple arrive and say they're here, we look with great joy.
They were in Madison, I think, back in about 1982.
Somewhere around early 1980s.
Yeah.
And then it was clear they were fully committed. It was almost as though they're Quakers, and then also they do stuff with medicine. That seemed to be the way they struck us. It was clear that they were very concerned about the country's health. And the notion that in this case involved policy changes and decisions, they were very much committed to the notion of single-payer health. And they strove tirelessly. They went to conferences, they went to political rallies, pushing the idea that this was a way that any civilized country should try to go. And they came up with very powerful arguments, and they debated with all sorts of groups. But sort of both of them had at their heart the notion that this is a point where the U.S. should really adopt the single-player system. Now, the other Quaker activities they were involved in were sort of all directions. Gene's death came relatively unexpectedly. He had gone on a tour with the Nation magazine, enjoyed that thoroughly, came back, his health took a turn for the worse, and then, as it turned out, he was back in Madison. He died on a Friday. The family were here, and the notion was, should we move ahead very quickly and have a memorial service, or wait maybe 2 or 3 weeks until people, the word got out, and we could have a much more gathering. And the decision was, no, we'll move ahead. He'll be buried on Sunday at his place with his family members taking part in the burial, and then we would have a memorial meeting Sunday evening. Then the question came about, how do you tell hundreds of people that somebody they love, who was alive at the beginning of the week, is no longer alive? And the way in which the network operated was absolutely fascinating. Phone calls, various kinds of lists. And we quickly decided we could not have the memorial meeting in the Quaker meeting house. It was much too small. We contacted the Unitarians. They very graciously opened up the meeting house for us on a Sunday night. So we began and had one of the most moving memorial services I've ever been at. And maybe other people here will share it. But the sense of oneness, the messages that were delivered were very, very powerful and moving from all dimensions of their lives. And then the question came, how do you end a memorial meeting? I was the clerk, and it was my sort of assignment to figure out when had people said all they felt they could say. And I felt this could go all night long. And then about the time I thought we probably should bring this to a close, their granddaughter said an absolutely wonderful statement. Mm-hmm. And I felt nobody could say something more. It was a notion that they had left a legacy and everybody in the room should feel an obligation to carry it out or a joy to carry it out. And so I said, let's shake hands, and that's it. And it was just an unforgettable meeting.
So I know you have to leave us in a few minutes, so I just want to get one last word just thinking about their philosophy, the way that they carried that out. It strikes me, you know, as you're talking about their belief in the single-payer system, their belief that it's just absurd that we're enmeshed in all of these conflicts worldwide, that peace is the only answer. And why can't people get that sometimes? I get, you know, in some of the interviews I did with Gene, he would just, you know, express his anger and his frustration. And yet they were also folks that, coupled with this idealism, they were enormously effective in terms of the scope of their activism, their ability to bring people around, to achieve compromise and solutions.
And they were tireless.
Yeah.
They'd go off for a weekend to a series of conferences and meetings and come back and attend the Quaker meeting in the afternoon or evening. So they just never seemed to quit.
All right. Go ahead, Shed.
In there. He just spent 9 days on a cruise doing exactly that in total heart failure. Literally. I mean, he never quit.
No, thank you. Thank you for punctuating that. Joanne Older, let me come next to you if I could. Again, maybe your reflections on what the Sunday evening was about, but as we talk about the Farleys, it just made sense from the minute I started planning this to talk about Gene and Linda, because they were such a partnership. Their love was so much a part of everything that they did. Do you have reflections on that?
They are perhaps the most perfect loving couple I ever knew. from the moment that I saw them together at Quaker meeting, they sat next to each other. They held hands. They in public, they held hands a lot. They were so much on the same beam with their concerns. And, of course, Linda told me the story, you know, how she felt. Well, she was really surprised that this handsome young man was interested in her being, you know, she had a club foot, I think, that was the result of polio? Or what was the...
No, she had just bad feet. Not polio.
Shed was clarifying, but why don't you go ahead if you could.
Well, in any case, as she describes it, how could he be in love with me? And as he described it, he spotted her right on as the woman of his dreams. And they raised this fabulous family in terms of everything else that they did. And I marvel at the family that I guess they managed to fit in family values and time along with everything else. I don't know if the children ever felt cheated, but I can't imagine
Never.
It since they seem to be able to do everything for everybody. I have to comment that whenever they were at a political gathering or any gathering, Linda was the more generous with her time. If somebody was talking to Linda, she wouldn't break away from them. And poor Gene, come on, Linda, let's go. He didn't say it out loud, but you could feel it. And but Linda always gave the last ounce of herself to wherever she was. And yet, at the same time, they talked about things they did together. They read books together. They went to movies together. They were the most together couple I ever knew.
Colby Baldwin, if I could, let me bring you into the conversation. You're shaking your head in affirmation at some of these observations. Did you also find that it was hard to separate out just the profound nature of the love that they felt for each other, how that translated into their work in the world?
Somehow, when you knew Gene and Linda, that you never saw them as individuals. They're always Linda and Gene. You know, that everything they did, it was just always, you know, as a couple. And, you know, people talk about, you know, finishing each other's sentences. It was sort of like that with Gene and Linda. And, you know, that I just think that they were both always very much in love. And I think that showed very much through in everything they did. And also, one of the things that I really, you know, I learned to appreciate and spending a lot of time with Gene, you know, was that, you know, the how much he respected his children. Mm. And he would talk just very much and positively about all the great things that they were doing. And it just, I mean, I'm always, you know, in awe of how he and Linda raised the kids. He says, we never had to, you know, be harsh with the kids because we just respected them and knew that they, you know, that if we just provide the little guidance that they would, you know, be sure that they were, you know, grow up to be their own person.
It so strikes me that the two of them really embodied, of course, this notion, too, of looking seven generations ahead, looking to the future of their grandchildren and their grandchildren's grandchildren. Did you have a sense of that awareness?
I think that's really, you know, that was really both Linda and Gene, how they saw the things and where, you know, that as a board member of the Farley Center, those were very much some of the things that he talked about, what he'd like to see in the future for the Farley Center, how Linda and he had planned on being sure that the community was involved, even while Linda was, you know, was still here with us, that they made sure that there was community gardens, that, you know, that the student, also being sensitive to cross-cultural issues. So involving the Hmong population and the Spanish-speaking populations and new immigrants from various and young people who wanted to learn how to farm. And so we think that, you know, that the way they looked at things were just that they were very much interested in cross-cultural issues in all facets of it, not just only in one part. And I think a lot of that is just, you know, they talked about that they were on the Navajo Nation as the first physicians where there was really nothing, you know, in many farms, Arizona. I'm a Navajo, so I can tell you a little bit about, you know, what the land is like, that, you know, that the place where they went, the nearest hospital is probably about 55 miles away and then 65 or 70 miles away from the other side to Ganado and also to Fort Defiance. So, you know, that they came into an area where there was really nothing. And I think after they left, you know, from that and that demonstration project, that that Indian Health Service was able to find some money to start, you know, the health services there. Before there was none, you know. And I can tell you that when I used to hitchhike to Ganado, you know, hospital, which is 55 miles away to, you know, for my son's needs. But, you know, they were there just before before I became a parent.
You were relating to me, too, that connection with that time in their life continued. It was mirrored in many of the Navajo crafts and blankets and other things that were throughout their home.
Well, when you look at their home, you know, their home, and I say home, not a house, reflect everything that who they were, the very much of a cross-culturals, you know, with all the beautiful art from all over the world and all the places they've traveled. And I think, you know, that one of the things that that both Jean and Linda say is that they were, you know, very much influenced by what they experienced on the Navajo Nation, and where actually it was a culture that was intact, and much more so, you know, where when they were there, majority of the Navajos did not speak English, and so everything would have to be by interpreting. You know, so Gene would still tell me. He says, "I know how to talk Navajo." I say, "Nez gaish," which means "does it hurt?" You know, so that was the common language that he always, you know, used. And I want to just tell really quickly a story about Linda. We had an American Indian student on campus, and her parents were here, and the man was diabetic. And, you know, was having health problems. None of the health services would take them because he didn't have any money. And I called Linda, as I tend to do when a student needs help, and they can't access the health system. So she says, take them to this clinic, and then they will decide on what they need to do. And then, you know, she says, and go ahead and pay for it, and I'll be sure and, you know, reimburse you. And so that was Linda, you know. So, you know, in this case, she ended up having to hospitalize, you know, the patient, the person, and then also call Indian Health Service in Washington, advocated for, you know, for him to be sure that, you know, that he was getting medical attention through the Indian Health Service. So, I mean, those were sort of the small things that, you know, that the highlights of some of the things that they, you know, that I saw Jean and Linda doing, you know, that I really very much appreciated their sensitivity to all cultures.
And I'm sure you feel the sense that it was communicating to the service, too, of carrying on their legacy. If I hadn't mentioned before, of course, you're the president of the Farley Center Board, and I'm sure that's your hope.
Well, and, you know, I mean, I think he set them in motions of what he and Linda expect us to do. And we are very, very fortunate to have the sons on the board, both at the Natural Path Sanctuary and also on the Farley Center for Peace, Social Justice, and Sustainability.
All right. I believe we do have a telephone call. Please go ahead with your comment or question, please.
Hi, my name is Kristen Sampson, and I am the niece of Linda and Jean Farley.
Hi, Kristen.
Hey, Shed, how are you?
Good.
And I just wanted to call in and just say, reiterate just what awesome people they were, and how they always made time for their family, and just made everybody feel really loved.
Oh, well, thank you so much for sharing that.
So they were just awesome people and a great example for everybody as far as how much they cared about others.
So that extended to nieces and nephews, too, it sounds like.
Yep, it did.
All right. Well, thanks so much for calling.
Yep.
Again, for those of you who may join us in midstream again, discussing the lives, celebrating the lives of Jean and Linda Farley. Jean, who passed away on November 8th of this year. Linda, who passed away from cancer back in 2009, two people who left an indelible mark on this community. And as we're discussing, in many ways, we hope that it'll continue. Continue around the table, Janet Parker, you're working with the Farley Center, and I apologize if you could maybe just explain what your role is there.
Sure.
You know, one other thing we talked about, one of the reasons I believe that the memorial service had to be held so quickly was the nature of the burial that awaited Jean, and of course that there's a story behind that in terms of what the Farley Center provides, the opportunities. If you could explain that as well.
That's right. So when the Farley Center for Peace, Justice, and Sustainability ideas got rolling with the generosity of the Farley family, they chose three functions of what the center would do, and one of them is the Natural Path Sanctuary. So that is a green cemetery. Jean was buried there. Linda was also buried on the land. And now many other people have been buried there, and many, many more have bought burial rights to be buried there. So that's a project that was waiting to happen in this region, and it's one function that the center is filling and will be into the future. It's a permanent land preservation strategy, so it's something that, you know, that 44 acres will always be be preserved. And then another function of the center is the farm incubator, and that's the part that I work on. 4 years ago, Jean and I started planning that. It was coming out of generosity that Linda and Jean had had from many years earlier, where they had extra farmland and they allowed people to use the land. I helped refer some people because I was working with the community gardens program in town, and then it has grown into a farm incubator, which is really the intersection between social justice work and sustainable agriculture. And again, it's an area where there was very much of an unmet need. It's a project that was waiting to happen in this region. Farm incubators are popping up around the country, but there wasn't one yet in this part of the world. And so we've helped many beginning farmers, many of them recent immigrants, to get started with land, shared equipment, marketing support, organic certification. And we've gotten a lot of help in these first years from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and through that gotten a lot of staff support for that function. But really what we work on is carrying it on, and what I've seen in the 4 years that I've been so lucky to work very closely with Gene and with his terrific family is, I think about it with the words of that children's song that you might know, love is something, if you give it away, you end up having more. Because the Farley family were tremendously generous. They gave what they would have inherited, this land. They gave it to become the Farley Center. And the results for Gene were very beautiful. You know, every day of his last 4 years, he's surrounded not just by loving family, but by a huge community of loving friends and colleagues who were there working to make the center a reality. And I feel really, really fortunate to have been one of the people working on it so far, and working with Omi and Chad and hundreds of other people on carrying this on.
And FarleyCenter.org? Yep. Is that the place to find out more?
FarleyCenter.org, yeah, to find out about the Green Cemetery piece, the farm incubator, and peace and justice projects.
And Janet, this is in part Omi's idea, but I think one of the things we need to do in the year ahead is perhaps to bring you and others back from the Farley Center as a means of continuing to get the word out and spreading that legacy. There's so much to talk about that radiates out from that place.
Yeah,
so
we'd love to come in and talk about all the projects. It's exciting. And welcoming people to visit. Come and see us and learn more.
Well, one aspect of what the Farleys have contributed, I think, to the world that maybe we don't know as much about, because some of this happened prior to their coming to Madison, but some of it during Gene's tenure as a director of the family practice division of UW Medical School, is their contribution to the whole philosophy of family practice. And John Fry, as I was reading about this, I think part of the way it was explained was For many doctors, the way they looked at medicine before was entirely an approach to the individual that they were treating. But there was a growing awareness that the family and also the larger community had to figure into that. I'm sure that's resonant with your own experience. I know earlier in your life you worked in Worcester at a community health center. I mean, anyway, am I right? Is there something that they latched onto that was important that spread itself in other places too?
I mean, that's right, John. But in a way, Gene and Linda didn't latch onto it, they created it.
Ah.
And so what people don't probably appreciate as much in this community, which is an extraordinary contribution and has rippled beyond our county and into the state and beyond that, with people such as Tammy Baldwin being affected by their passion and their interest. But Gene really was a founder in the true sense of that word of an academic discipline called family medicine. And it was started with a bunch of people, all of whom were in their late 30s and early 40s in 1960s, and who kept coming back and saying, we need to recreate education in a way that met the needs of communities, met the needs of patients, and which was at that point in history general practice, and was slowly dying out to the point where there was a real sense that there was not going to be a generalist in medicine by the end of the 1970s. And so what they did, and he was really the most... As everyone knows about Gene's passion and his interest in something, he'll carry it as far as he can carry it. Got a group of people together. As I said, most of them were young men who were coming from community practice, like Gene and Linda. Both came from the small town where they practiced in upstate New York, and found academic homes in some very strange places. one of which was the University of Rochester, which was not necessarily a hotbed of family medicine or generalist training, but Gene convinced them that they really needed somebody like him. And I'm not sure if they convinced Gene or Gene convinced them, but my suspicion is Gene did the convincing, that with his background in the Navajo, which certainly, you know, as you were saying, is really an enormous influence on the way they saw medicine could be practiced, with a real sharing and community approach and lots of other kinds of things, to go back into a private practice setting, which in those days was pretty much solitary, maybe small group practice, and create a new idea of training people together, nurses, physicians, pharmacists, physical therapists. And what Gene did was started the program at the University of Rochester, and has been probably the most influential trainer of leaders in family medicine over the last 45 or 50 years. So that his effect on education has been extraordinary, that I keep saying that there are about 110,000 of us in this country who are his children and grandchildren and nieces, and his legacy is one that is really remarkable. The things that people don't know about Gene, and came out the weekend that he died, and I happened to be out of town, so I was up in a mountain and didn't hear about it until Saturday, and I was a long way from here. Mm-hmm. But people heard at the North American Primary Care Research Group, which is the largest meeting of primary care researchers in the Western Hemisphere, was having its annual meeting, and Gene had been involved with some of the ideas around that organization, and so they had a spontaneous memorial tribute to Gene, which was really moving. It was led by the current president of the organization, who's one of Gene's students. So what you see, I think, for me, is the opportunity for people who take on education, and Gene really took on education and changed it by bringing a lot of us in who believe that it could be changed, and Gene, as everyone knows, is always enthusiastic about change, and so we needed some, not a lot of prodding, but we needed a lot of support. And so what happened was we were able to change the face of American medicine. And so I think what happened is that his remarkable contributions were, for me, the education that has rippled out throughout the country and around the world because of the things that he and Linda did. And, you know, I had an opportunity to do an oral history on Gene many years ago, and one of the things that was really funny and is really kind of typical for everybody who knows him is he kept wanting to we kept wanting to write about his work at the University of Rochester, and he kept using the word we. And anybody who knows Gene and Linda knows that he always thinks in the word we, you know, that Linda and so I think it was one of those interesting things where Linda's contributions have always been to be the soul of the clinical work and the soul of the practice and the educational process. And Gene was often the person who was, in a leadership position. But it was a remarkable journey for both of them.
Again, another conversation we'll have to continue next year. Sounds like there's a real richness there. Mark Miller, I want to bring you into the conversation. Before I do, Melissa, could we play the clip labeled Linda? I'm just going to play maybe about 30 seconds or so of this, but just give you a little flavor. This is Linda explaining in 2007 kind of the state of where things were at with health reform here in Wisconsin.
So hard to explain healthy Wisconsin in a few sentences. Yes, indeed. In fact, it would cost about $15 billion, which unfortunately the opposition is saying a tax, which of course it isn't at all. It would save about $2 billion over what the current healthcare costs are in Wisconsin. It would cut out a huge amount of the overhead, just as like you're describing is so in France. As you know, in this country, in virtually every state, the number of people that are employed just to administer or make the system of healthcare try to work, which it doesn't at all. The billing you talked about, for example. In a hospital in this country, you know, a 900-bed hospital in Boston would have 300 or more people in the billing department. And so the system that's coming forth in Wisconsin would do away with an awful lot of that overhead cost. It would essentially be a...
And we'll cut this a little short, and I pledged to get this whole interview up online. I was delighted to discover I had an hour with them, and the context was an author who had written about contrast between the French and U.S. systems back in 2007. But Mark, things have changed so much. Of course, this is 2007. It's still the Bush administration. A lot of the attention was on the states, not on Obamacare and other things. But Linda's talking about, the current incarnation at the time in 2007 of all of this. But Gene and Linda, I think, were there from the 80s in terms of strong advocates for the needed change, as John was alluding to. This is a lot of what motivated Tammy Baldwin to make this a front and center issue. Could you talk about their impact in the political realm and healthcare reform?
Well, absolutely. They were tireless advocates for a single-payer health insurance plan that was state-administered. And when they first came to Madison, well, among the first people they met were my own parents, Ed and Midge Miller. And that's how I made my acquaintance with the Farleys. They, together with Midge, created the Madison Institute, which I participated with in its early years, and healthcare reform was a big part of its agenda. When I decided to run for the Assembly, it was Linda Farley that I went to ask, tell me about how health insurance works and how the medical system works. And so, like she does with everybody, she focuses on you. You're the only person in the universe at the time whether you're a patient or somebody who's running for office that needs to be educated. I had a great benefit of her educating me, just as she was in this clip you just played. We introduced several versions of a single-payer health plan here in the state of Wisconsin. That was the genesis of Gene and Linda's work. When we finally got into a position to actually pass something, it was Healthy Wisconsin, and it was a modification. It was not completely what Gene and Linda would have liked. They thought the universal system would have been better, but it was close. And it actually passed the state Senate, which was then under Democratic control. And it went away in the during the conference committee. But it was their firm belief that any state that passed a universal health insurance plan would achieve such savings and such a huge increase in the benefits to the citizens that it would become an overwhelming force in other states. But it just had to get passed somewhere, and they thought Wisconsin was as good a place as any. And they were eternally optimistic. They always believed that peace, justice, truth, and fairness would triumph. And so they were never discouraged by setbacks. They were always enthusiastic about the possibility of a better future for every single human being on Earth. And that was, I think, the thing that endeared them and why they continued to work so hard. And I think one of the best compliments, I know we referred earlier, Joy Alder referred earlier to the comments made by their granddaughter, Becca Farley, at the memorial service, challenging everybody there to go forward with the inspiration that Gene and Linda Farley provided. But my own daughter said, I hope I can live my life the way Gene and Linda lived theirs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. We should note briefly, there was a time when Gene had considered 2 points of his life running for Congress. Yet, I'm sure you'll agree, despite the fact he didn't make it there, he still, both Farleys were very effective in the political realm.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, at their service, I think there was one member from the county board who said, we're all going to miss a very generous contributor to our political campaigns,
yeah.
Which Gene and Linda Farley always was. The reason Gene Farley withdrew was because he thought a candidate that had a better chance of winning the election was going to succeed. That was Paul Soglin. And so out of the generosity of his spirit, which was always the case, he withdrew.
He did that in as many things selfless way. Melissa, we need, if we could, that last clip from Gene. This is the tail end of my interview with him back in September 16th. We were talking with Gene, Malala Chikasa Anana, Vel Phillips, who had all been to the March on Washington, and this was his vision for what lays ahead 50 years from now.
50 years from now, let's say, as we face tremendous climate change, unsteady uncertainty about the environment in which we all exist, the human community, which involves all humans throughout the whole world, has to figure out how we're going to evolve ourselves through the climate changes, through all the changes that are coming. And it can't be through war, hate, hostility. We have to learn How can we finally live together, work together, and really help sustain this fantastic biosphere planet in which we are all share and will live and die together? So
all right.
We have to get together.
Obie Baldwin, any final thoughts?
I think what you just heard is really what summarizes Gene's life, you know, that he was always looking forward and always very generous and kind to every living being and even the land and, you know, all of the area, and climate change was very important to him.
All right. Anyone else around the table have some other?
One of the phrases that I remember Gene saying frequently, and it epitomizes his faith in the human spirit, was, We the people can accomplish a better future.
All right. Joanne, any thoughts?
Well, only that they were exemplary friends, with a capital F, Quakers, and the best personal friends anybody could have had.
Yeah. Go ahead, Janet.
Just some reflections from the memorial. Tillman, his son, said, you know, in two words, Gene was about openness and optimism. And then some of his healthcare advocate friends repeated the slogan of everybody in, nobody out.
Yeah. And Chad, do you have just a few seconds left? Any other things that you'd like to weigh in on?
Well, you know, what Janet just said, everybody in, nobody out. That's how we grew up. Our house was always full of people, the kids' friends, the parents' friends, just people all over the place, all the time. And it was truly, in retrospect, an amazing family to grow up into, just because of the freedoms we had and the role models that we kids had. I mean, just remarkable.
All right. It'll be Baldwin, Joseph and Joanne Elder, Mark Miller, Janet Parker, Chad Farley, John Fry, and Shed Farley. Thank you so much for enriching us this hour with these wonderful memories of Gene and Linda Farley.